Good morning. Welcome to Center Finance. It's Thursday, January 24th. Present at the table are Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Meyer, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, and myself, Senator Kelly. Today we're going to hear from the Department of Revenue. Commissioner Butcher will be here making a presentation regarding our revenue picture, as well as some of the methodology used and some of the changes that have been made regarding that revenue picture. Commissioner Butcher, if you'd like to come to the table, please state your name and your association for the record. Thank you. Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. With me, and we'd like to take the committee through a number of presentations. The first one will focus on kind of the big picture revenue forecast and dig a little bit into the price forecast aspect of the forecast. We'll then have the Deputy Commissioner for the Department, Bruce Tangeman, as well as the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Bill Barron, come up and walk through the production forecast we've made. Most of you probably know we've made changes to how we look at the long-term production forecast, and they'll walk you through the rationale for that. And then if we have time, the Department of Revenue's other Deputy Commissioner, Angela Rodell, and I will walk you through the savings accounts.
Thank you. Proceed.
Slide two is an outline of what we'll be covering, with a 10-year overview for the committee's benefit, going into a comparison between the spring 2012 forecast to the fall and the changes that have been made as a result of that. We'll then look at total revenue, unrestricted revenue, specifically oil and non-oil revenue broken down, and then, as I mentioned, how we came about coming up with the oil price for the forecast and then the production. This slide is our 10-year forecast, and I won't dig too deeply into it because we've got more detailed slides that dig into these numbers coming up. But you can see the blue row gives you the next 10 years what we believe the price forecast will be, and you can see the expectation is it to hover around $108 to $112. Gradually increasing as the years go on, as it's inflation proofed. You can also see in the yellow row, that's the production forecast, and you can see the production continuing to do what it's been doing for the last few decades, which is continuing to decline. And as a result of that, you can also see that the general fund unrestricted revenues, although they bounce around a little bit, it's generally a decline as well. The chief reason for that being, of course, that the production on a yearly basis continues to decline. Slide five shows the specifics of a comparison between the spring 2012 forecast the department came out with in April of last year, right before the end of the legislative session, and the updated forecast that came out in December in the revenue sources book. As you can see, the price of oil is down about $1.77 from what we had forecast in the spring. Production is down about 10,000 barrels more than we had anticipated in the spring as well. And the primary reason for that is the beginning of the fiscal year, late summer, when a lot of the maintenance goes on the North Slope, the production was at a much lower level than we had anticipated when we collected the data in the spring. And so as a result of those things, we're looking at about $928 million less in the current fiscal year for FY13 than we had projected in the spring. Other factors that contributed to the reduction besides a lower level of production and a little bit lower price is spending was on the North Slope was higher than we had anticipated in the spring, so that resulted in less revenues coming in through our calculations for production tax, and to a smaller degree, The corporate taxes were down a little bit from what we expected, and the investment income was a few million less than we had anticipated. As you look at FY14, which is the fiscal year that whose budget you're working on currently, our forecast in the fall compared to the spring is a slight tick higher in oil price, but basically the same. We're expecting 29,000 barrels less in FY14 than we had anticipated in the spring. And as a result, we're also now forecasting a little bit higher spending on the North Slope than we had anticipated in the spring. So we're now looking at a forecast of $678 million less than what was presented in the spring forecast. So if you take a look at the current FY13 fiscal year along with the FY14 fiscal year, it's combined about $1.6 billion less in our most recent forecast than we had anticipated and forecast in the spring. Also a reminder for the committee that we will be coming out with an updated spring forecast that will come out just before the end of session. It's usually in the first few days of April, and the reason why is we wait till the end of the first quarter of the calendar year, March 31st, when we get the true-ups from the companies for their calendar year 2012 and factor into any potential issues we see that we didn't anticipate having an effect on that spring forecast. So you will get an updated forecast a few weeks before the end of session.
Mr. Chairman, when do you
Senator
want
Hoffman,
excuse me.
Go ahead and ask as you will.
My question is on FY 2014, what was the justification for the reduction of the 29,000 barrels?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, although we can't get into the specifics of exact projects and exact companies, in general, we're seeing a few project delays that weren't anticipated in the spring, as well as reduced performance expectations in a couple of areas as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Brocher.
Taking a look at slide six, this takes a look at the actuals for fiscal year 12 compared to what our forecasts are for fiscal year 13 and fiscal year 14, a breakdown between unrestricted general fund, designated general fund, and other restricted revenue. Not a big surprise in a lot of these categories. Our investment revenue in the unrestricted general fund, you can see we have forecasted a small dip there, in that we're being even more conservative than we have been about what our investment revenue would get in the department because of the continued low interest rates and kind of the post-2008 environment that we live in. The of most note as you look at these numbers is when you look at other restricted revenue under investment revenue, you're going to see that the actuals for FY12 were $109 million. The forecast for the current year and FY14 are up over $3 billion. And the primary reason for that is the permanent fund. The permanent fund had a more or less flat year in FY12, which followed about a 20% year in FY11. And so you see very little for FY12. However, the expectation in the fund is that it will continue to operate at the level it's expected to. So that's why you're seeing forecasted numbers of over $3 billion. And in fact, for the first 6 months of fiscal year 13, the permanent fund's done about 7%. So it remains to be seen what number we're going to get to in FY13, but it's looking, unless the next 6 months go very poorly, that we will be looking at a healthier number than we saw in FY12. Slide seven is a breakdown of the petroleum revenue by tax and royalty. The royalty number is a number that we've backed out the royalties that go into the permanent fund and the half of 1% that goes into the school fund to show you what the unrestricted revenue from royalty would be that would be available for appropriation. You can see by far the largest number is of revenue brought in comes from the production tax, the severance tax, and then about a half a billion dollars coming in from corporate income tax, and then property tax from the oil industry averages around $100 million, give or take a few, depending on the year. Slide 8 shows you the unrestricted non-oil revenue. And as you can see by the total at the bottom, it's a little over $600 million. As you're aware, over 90% of the state budget is paid for by oil, so this is a relatively small piece of the revenue puzzle compared to oil, obviously. But you see the other funds we do bring in, and corporate income, non-oil corporate income taxes, mining license tax, insurance premiums, tobacco tax, motor fuel tax, and other smaller taxes. And also factored into this is investments. Slide 9 is a slide we're all very familiar with, which shows the production history and forecast and the production decline of the North Slope, peaking in 1990 at 2.1 billion barrels a day and dropping to the current level. And this is a big picture with a breakdown of Prudhoe Bay as well as the Prudhoe satellites, Kuparuk satellites, Endicott, Alpine. And the next slide shows you more of a close-up of more recent history from 2002 to 2022, which is the 10 years we're looking forward in our forecast. And of particular note on this slide is the large effect that current legacy fields will have in the future for our forecasts. As the department looks at it, you can see with Prudhoe Bay in the blue and Kuparuk in the purple that we project even 10 years out that the majority of the oil that we'll be looking at will be coming from legacy fields, with somewhat less than 50% coming from new fields. That, of course, can certainly change. Every year is a new snapshot, a new updated forecast, and when and if there's new oil found and new oil potentially into production, this could change. But as we look at it today, at the beginning of 2013, this is how it's viewed. Focusing now, Mr. Chairman, on the fall 2012 oil price forecast. The department has been doing this differently the last 4 or 5 years than it did previously. Previously, most of the work for both production and price were done internally in the department. And fairly recently, we began doing things a little bit different. The Department of Revenue sets up an oil price forecast session, which generally happens in the fall. Last year, it was on October 2nd. We invite a number of participants from around the state. This year, we had 31 participants from the Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, Labor, OMB, University of Alaska, Legislative Finance, other outside participants, folks from ICER. We've had legislators in the past. And it's an all-day session where we go through and we talk through supply, demand, geopolitics, the financial markets, outside experts' forecasts. We ask the group to forecast what they believe the price will be, as well as we bring in the federal forecast, the Energy Information Agency, the New York Mercantile Exchange, other analysts. We bring in guest speakers, and this last year, we brought in, from Econ One, Barry Pulliam, as well as the late Dr. Tony Finizza, who was chief economist at ARCO for over 20 years. We also had Samuel Van Vector, who's president of Economic Insights, and he's an economist on the West Coast, as well as a senior economist for Wells Fargo, Mark Vintner, who is frequently on CNN and CNBC as interviewed as an economist for their perspectives on what they saw happening globally with oil and very specifically with the price. As a result, the department blends the forecasting session as well as analyst forecasts, worldwide analyst forecasts, NYMEX and EIA to come up with what we believe the price forecast will be for the next 10 years. Slide 13 shows you where the price has been for the last 4 years, as well as a general idea of where a lot of the different expert forecasts were moving forward for the next 4 or 5 years. The outliers on the high side is the Energy Information Agency, the EIA, is quite bullish on what the price is going to be. On the low side, NYMEX believes it's going to be lower than what we saw from most of the analysts. And then the numbers in the middle, you can see the dotted blue line is where a number of analysts' forecasts that we combined ended up. The dotted brownish line is the price forecast, and then you can see the Department of Revenue's final forecast line is the red. So it's kind of right in the middle, a little lower, but right in the middle of where we see a lot of the experts and a lot of the official forecasts coming in. As we've met with the rating agencies over the last couple of years, we've actually gotten kudos for our conservative price forecast. I believe 5 of the last 6 years, the department's price forecast has been under what the actual price is. Not that we're shooting for conservative numbers, because we're shooting to be as accurate as possible, but when the rating agencies look at it, they look to see that the state wouldn't be potentially putting erring on the high side, which would show a higher revenue amount than might be necessary. So that's been an area we feel pretty comfortable about.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the with your new team and new approach, do you believe that your projections are going to be more accurate than the other four forecasters on this chart than previous?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I think that the way we've been doing things here will keep us about where we've been, which I feel like we've been pretty accurate, a little on the conservative side, but you know, you certainly want to err on being more conservative on something like this than going the other direction. So I feel like this is a piece we've done pretty well at, and I think we're going to continue to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Taking a look at slide 14, and this is not a slide I'll walk you through. It's just for the committee's benefit, kind of long term, and it's a price sensitivity slide, which gives you an idea at what the projected production is, and what the you can then look and see at different price levels how much general fund unrestricted revenue we would be bringing in as a result. So if there were to be a swing after the budget passes, or even before, of a lot lower number or a lot higher number, it gives the committee an idea of what the state would be bringing in under a number of scenarios every $10 a barrel, basically. So it just kind of gives you a ballpark of what we potentially would be looking at based on a change in the price of oil. With that, Mr. Chairman, if there aren't any more questions, I'd like to bring up Deputy Commissioner Tangeman and Director Barron, and I'd like to kind of preface their presentation a little bit by...
Mr. Buescher, before you do, Senator Olson has a question.
Yeah, Commissioner, thank you very much for your presentation this morning. I'd like to look at slide 9 and 10, where you've got the production historical downslope that's going on there. I guess one of the things that I see, if you're going out to 2022, are you not anticipating there's going to be more oil in the pipeline with the offshore exploration that's going on? And when do you anticipate that's going to be hitting the pipeline throughput once the Kulik and the other Shell, as well as the other oil companies, are going to be starting to in production up on either the Beaufort or the Chukchi?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Olson. Mr. Tangeman and Mr. Barron will be digging into that, but I will answer it to say that we forecast very specifically what we believe, and there's three different tranches of levels of expectation of oil development, and they'll get into detail on that. But offshore, much like shale oil, is something that we discuss. We certainly all need to be aware of the potential. However, there haven't been the wells drilled, and there hasn't been enough analysis done for the department to try to give any kind of an estimate on, number one, when production might begin, and number two, when it does begin, what level of production that would be. So that's kind of in our general discussion of, there are things on the horizon that aren't included in this forecast because we frankly don't have enough information at this point from the companies to even give a ballpark idea of when that would be.
Last question is, so you're not anticipating any offshore stuff coming through before 2022?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's not that we're saying it's not going to happen, it's just that we're saying we don't have enough information. We have not received enough information from the companies to give even a ballpark idea of when we would put that in or how much it would be in for.
Am I mistaken? We don't have revenue from offshore. Is it zero, or do we have any revenue from offshore?
Mr. Chairman, we don't get any direct, we would not get any direct revenue from OCS. In theory, more oil in the pipe would reduce the tariff, and we would see benefits from that with our royalty oil. So there would be an effect. It would just be a very small effect.
Okay. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can take this offline later, but are there going to be a discussion in the future here about investments and the return on those investments, or is this the point to ask that question?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, is that the state's investments? Yes, we have a presentation prepared that I think is third in line of our three today that will walk through all of our funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And going into the change in production forecast that Mr. Tangeman and Mr. Barron will go through, I just wanted to preface that a little bit by 2 years ago when I started this job and presented the production forecast that had frankly been worked on before I came into the department. The criticism I heard the most from the finance committees was that the department does a good job short term in projecting what the production is in the current fiscal year and the next fiscal year, but the long term production forecast had been overly optimistic. Well, that's something certainly that I had recognized when I worked as a legislative aide. We had heard from legislative finance, we've heard from members of the press, we've heard from members of the public, and we've certainly heard from the legislature that that has always been the case. And so I gave my word to the committees that we would work on that and we would work to try to improve how we do the long-term production forecast. There's no perfect forecast, obviously, and the further out you get, the less likely you are to be accurate. But as we dug into it, we realized that looking out 10 years, the Department of Revenue had been 40 to 65% overly optimistic on its production forecast. And so it's not a matter of just you go out 10 years, it's difficult to figure out what the production is going to be. It was always optimistic. It was never the other direction. And frankly, we've looked at a historical decline of 6% on the North Slope. The department has never forecast long-term more than 2.5% a year. And in fact, most forecasts, it was even much less than that. So the department hadn't been doing as good a job as I think we could to look long-term and give legislators and the governor and the public a better idea long-term of what we might be looking for. So that was kind of the genesis of how we reached out to the Department of Natural Resources and asked them to play a more central role in working with us to try to get a more accurate long-term production forecast.
Welcome to Finance. Please state your name and association.
For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue.
Good morning. Bill Barron, Director of Oil and Gas.
Go ahead, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you and discuss the changes that we've implemented on the production forecast. As we all know, oil revenue constitutes better than 90% of the state revenue. It's critical that the decision makers from both the executive branch and the legislative branch have the best available information for both short-term budgeting and long-term planning. To that end, AS 3707020 was established declaring that OMB must set out significant assumptions used in the projection with sufficient detail to enable the legislature to rely on the fiscal plan in understanding, evaluating, and resolving issues of state budgeting. So this cross-section of various forecasts over the last decade depict the consistent over-optimism over the years that this body and the executive branch have had to rely on when it comes to the production forecast. As you can see, all the lines are fairly close in year one, even in year two. But as Commissioner Butcher pointed out, when you get out to the out years, six to 10 years out, that error rate increases from 40 to 60-65%. DOR is the process that DOR has relied on over the last decades. We've relied on input from the industry in order to formulate the production forecast. They're the experts in the field. They're the ones operating the fields. Therefore, we work hand in hand with them to get the best available information in order to put the production forecast together. However, when the commissioner had us start looking into this a little bit, and this is where I need to be careful sitting next to my friend who's an engineer, we noticed that it wasn't the wrong group of people, but it was an incomplete group of people that were working on the production forecast. We have a consultant that we hire who is a production engineer, petroleum engineer, and he would speak with fellow petroleum engineers from the industry to come up with the possible, and I emphasize the word possible, production, because the people that weren't in the room were the budget folks from the industry. So really what was happening was it was the best case scenario that the two sides were discussing, and that's what was evolving into the production forecast. So budgets were not being considered.
Senator Bishop.
One quick question. You talk with the industry about production forecast. Did I hear you say that when
yep.
you're forecasting?
Yes.
Just a question for me is, in the last year, did they alert you to that they were going to be doing a turnaround this past summer? You know, because we keep hearing back of the, you know, we've got this disparity in their production forecast in this year, and we got less revenue coming in. And I know that there was a couple of turnaround projects there on the North Slope. I just did they tell you that, okay, next summer we're going to be doing a turnaround and production's going to go from X to Y?
Through the chair, Senator, every summer the North Slope producers typically do turnarounds at various flow stations or general gathering centers. They do that because their production is typically lower in the summer than it is in the winter. Kind of counterintuitive, but the turbines and their work better when it's cold. So during the summertime is the opportune time for them to take plants down and do major overhauls in preparation for the peak production that they have in the winter. So to that regard, did they advise us that this is going on? That I can't specifically address, but it would be intuitive that we would expect that.
Okay.
What we're trying to do in this exercise is not necessarily look in a microscopic scale of month by month, but we're looking at a more holistic approach toward overall forecasting and planning going out in the future. But it would be very, very typical for those operators to do summertime shut-ins.
Then one quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Just for my benefit, are you an engineer or a geologist?
Through the chair, I'm a petroleum engineer.
Okay. Because I know engineers and geologists get offended if you don't make that distinction, so I just want to make that clear.
Through the chair, while that may be true in most cases, my dad was an exploration geologist, so I have to tread very carefully on how to respond.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Tangerman.
As Commissioner Butcher stated, in 2011, we were greeted in this committee and the other body's finance committee with a great amount of concern regarding the historically over-optimistic production forecasts. Here's a couple quotes. I won't read them in their entirety, but just a sample of some of the concerns. Representative Costello mentioned, is it possible for the department to come forward with a plan for providing more accountability to the production forecasts? Representative Dugan mentioned something along the same lines. What I'm asking is that I be given something that will give me more confidence that the projections that we see, not necessarily 100% accurate, but that they have taken into account everything that they can and we've got the best shot we can. And I think that, again, goes back to the 100% possible that was being reflected in the overly optimistic forecast, not the probable, the possible. So that led to the discussion that started soon afterwards. Director Barron was in the room back in 2011, and right after that meeting, he approached us and said, first he asked, why is revenue the only one at the table talking about a production forecast? And he offered to help, which led to a lot more work on his plate, but it was important to have Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources involved working hand-in-hand with revenue on this process, because they are experts on that side of the house when it comes to the rocks and what's possible and what's probable. So I'll now turn it over to Director Barron to walk through some of the technical aspects of the changes we've implemented.
Thank you very much. The exhibit you see in front of you is what we affectionately called a spider diagram. And this is kind of where I started working with a team of revenue, just trying to get my arms around and the division's arms around what kind of magnitude of a problem or issue are we dealing with. And the exhibit you have in front of you is a representation of the error by year. So as you look at the spider web, it starts at year one and works its way around to year 10. And the blue line and red line illustrate the error out in time of the 2001 and 2002 forecasts. The green line is an average of from 2001 to 2010 errors associated with the forecast that was presented by DOR historically to this body. There's many ways to illustrate this. This is just kind of one of the ones that I look at, because there's sometimes very interesting patterns that develop in a spider diagram that aren't necessarily reflected in a bar chart or a pie chart. So what you're seeing is, interestingly enough, an outward spiral, gaining uncertainty and gaining error with every year. And again, it's just not an isolated case. Again, if you look at the green line, that is the average for all those years, 2001 through 2010. Clearly reaching out to where you're over 60, right at 60%, over 60% by year 10. So that's kind of the, and I actually wasn't surprised when I was advised how they were doing their forecasting in the past. This exhibit did not surprise me at all. Enter. So that's addressing the history, and then we just wanted to try and take a look at we wanted to come up with basically a different scenario, a different method, but also trying to capture the inner workings of the two teams. So what I asked working independently of each other, and I think that's really important to understand, the two teams worked independently of each other, and then we rolled our exhibits in together to see if it fit. The exhibit you see in front of you is a statistical measure of standard deviation. I would offer that I want you to notice that there's been a change of scale on the y-axis. That is now a logarithmic scale. In difference to the geologists and the accountants in the room, typically engineers want to look at production forecasting and production decline in a semi-log manner, because if it's an exponential decline, it will be linear on a semi-log exhibit, which is what we would typically look at. And even if it was not, say it was a hyperbolic, which a lot of these fields are, it's still closer to representing a straight line rather than what it would be reflected in a Cartesian plot.
You realize I have no idea what you just said.
So through the chair, or to the chair, that is really fortunate for me, I think. We can have that. I can be happy to show you what I'm showing you in a little bit. Maybe it'll be more clear. What I'm trying to do is show by changing the scale, it allows for clearer understanding of declines rather than being confused with a slope that begins to curve in a Cartesian plot. If it's just a normal XY grid, it will tend to flatten out and be a bit misrepresentative of what you're actually seeing in the field.
Thank you.
So what you've got is you've got confidence intervals, the green confidence interval, the solid dashed green on top and the green dot, is a confidence interval standard deviation between 1992 and 2011. Of all the production through that time, what would be the highs and lows? So again, what we're saying is over time, there's increases, decreases, ups and downs, and what would be the standard deviation as you project forward? That includes new fields, that includes fields that were shut in, that includes everything through that time frame. So that's one confidence interval. The other confidence interval I ask them to do is from 1992 through 2006. And if you look on the screen, my magic dot, the original was all the way through this data. And the next one is just through this data. And you can see there's two different curves. And the flattening is during that 2006-2008 is a combination of things, Alpine coming on, and also the significant impact of gas cap water injection at Prudhoe Bay. So what I ask him to do is take a look at the lower side of production, and assuming that we don't know when some of those impacts of gas cap water injection and other issues will begin to taper off, so we have a lower level of confidence window, and that would be the purple. And again, these are just statistical measures, just mathematics crunching through. So let's get really grounded on what we have. We have three, and to Senator Olson's questions, we actually have four tranches of items to address. In a production forecast, we're only addressing three tranches, and I'll clearly, hopefully, clarify some of the fourth tranche for you, Senator. The first is the currently producing, what we'd also refer to as the old oil. This is the stuff, we're really creative in our names. This is the stuff that's currently producing. It is existing fields, existing wells, et cetera. And this information is available through AOGCC. This is from the reports that the operators present on a monthly basis to various agencies. So that is the first tranche. The second tranche, which now begins to constitute what we call new oil, the first is under development. And these are projects. This would be production from projects that are incremental to existing fields and or new fields. A key piece of this is that these are projects identified by individual companies that have been sanctioned by senior management, and funds have been allocated for that work. Very clear, let's make sure we all understand what that is. These are wells and facilities that are in some stage of development. Long lead time items might have been ordered. Wells are currently being drilled, but not online. Not online. Again, not currently producing. Pads may be being built. And some of these projects could be well out in the future, even if in the existing fields. Gas cap water injection, for example, took probably, before they actually had a result, was probably somewhere between 5 and 8 years in engineering and development. That would have been a project that we would have included in under development. So again, there's a time component as in these that we need to address. The second tranche of new oil is under evaluation. And these are projects that are likely to occur in the future, but haven't really met the threshold of confidence that the industry says that they are going to commit primary funds for in a big way. These may be, and every company is a little different, and when the revenue consultant interviewed the companies, he would ask these types of questions. Is this project something that you would consider under development or under evaluation? And we kind of just let them tell us what they were going to tell us. Some companies would have a project that might be in their perspective under development, and another one might consider that same project under evaluation. Kind of depends on the company, but we just have to absorb some of that. What's important here is that the under evaluation is really got more risk to it. They're really not firmed up. They may have had one well drilled, maybe a delineation. It looks like it's pretty good, They're gearing up for 3D seismic, maybe a couple of more delineation wells, but they haven't actually committed that this is a go-to project yet. To Senator Olson's question about stuff that is even further out, the next tranche that is not included in any forecast is what we would call exploration. And that is so speculative that it would not be wise to include in any forecast of production at this juncture. The work that Shell is doing would be exploration. The work that Repsol is doing is exploration. The activities associated with Great Bear, clearly exploration. Even though Great Bear has two wells down, it's still clearly an exploration model. So that would be excluded from any of this forecasting.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, just a quick question. In the forecast that we're looking at, and related to Senator Olson's question earlier, are we really dealing with oil that Alaska will realize a return, a profit from, or income from, or revenue from, such as we do now? You don't have offshore included in this concept. You don't have other fields included in this concept, do you?
Through the chair, no, sir, we don't. But to be clear, let's think about the work that Repsol is doing. They've got a couple of wells drilled. They clearly have still categorized these as exploration activities. If after this exploration, this winter drilling season, if they feel like it is a project that probably will go forward, they would probably give us a forecast next year that would be classified under the under evaluation category.
But there's different types of oil, though. That's on state land.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
So it would fall under the same regime, or however you want to word it, that you're doing your
Through
forecast.
Through the chair, on. Yes, sir.
OCS with Shell, for example, would not. It's a totally different oil. It's going to be a totally different impact on.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Certainly. So just a couple of quick items on risk. Risk is the probability an event occurring and the potential impact of that occurrence. And these are all references out from Society of Petroleum Engineering articles published over time. Good exploration and production company business requires the assessment of technical and non-technical risk. This is one of my favorites. The ability to convey the relative riskiness of various oil and gas projects in a consistent manner is an elusive and desirable goal. The industry in its own regard is trying to send a message to those that are willing to listen that as you get further out in time, you have less confidence in really what the production profile is going to be, or what the resource is going to be, or what the costs are going to be. So you have to roll all of these assessments in. And this is what the industry does on a daily basis. So let's talk about the risk a little bit. Currently producing was not risked in this forecast. The DOR consultant looked at all the production profiles, built them up from the ground up, as we would say, well by well, looked at each well in the field, rolled it up into an aggregate at the PA and field level, and members of my staff, including me, looked at every one of the field graphs to give kind of a feel of whether that was reasonable or unreasonable. And I can tell you that the currently producing is at least reasonable.
Senator Bishop.
Did you say PA?
A participating area.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
So
before you jump off, Bill, I would like to interject here that it's important to note that the process that we went through for this does not apply to the current fiscal year we're in, fiscal year 13, or fiscal year 14, the budget you folks will be working on. And even if it had been included, it would have applied to under development, under evaluation slices, which are minimal, and the risk applied would have been very minimal also. So it's important to note it doesn't apply to 13 or 14. It starts in FY 15.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As it's relating to fracking, where would that fall under your production forecasting, if at all, and any accounting of risk?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. The completion technology known as hydraulic fracturing is very common in the field, even today. Roughly 25 or over 25% of all the wells in Alaska have been hydraulically fracture stimulated. That is a typical operation. Would not necessarily impact plus or minus a great deal of any of these forecasts because it's a common occurrence.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dunleavy.
Fracking refers to the process, and it's often associated with shale oil. But the fracking in this case is not shale oil. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct. Hydraulic fracturing is a stimulation technique that has been utilized by the industry, gosh, for close to 100 years. And it's just gotten better and better over time. But it is, while it's typically now associated with shale, it is the only way shale will produce.
It's through fracking.
It's through hydraulic fracturing. But it is a very common approach to increase production, even from classic sandstone formations and carbonates. Very typical.
I believe I know the answer, but do we have any shale oil online at this point?
Through the chair, no, sir.
Thank you.
As a follow-up to that point, also through the chair, Senator, it's not included in this forecast either, because it would be classified as an exploration component, not an under evaluation or under development. It is the fourth tranche.
You know, I missed the operative word on that. It would be known as an exploration what?
Tranche.
No, before that. Proceed. I'll talk to you later.
So, but part of what we need to understand, again, is there's technical and non-technical risks. And the closer you are to the event occurring, the higher confidence you have. The further out the event is going to take place, the less confidence you have. That's just intuitive. That's no different than the weather. You have a pretty good idea of what the weather might be tomorrow, but you know in 90 days there's still going to be weather. You just don't know what it's going to be. So we looked at one factor.
Just a moment. Senator Meyer.
Thank you. A couple questions. First of all, just getting back to, I think, Senator Hoffman's question, the oil shale, as you said, is still in the exploration stage and still very highly speculative as far as whether or not it even works in the Arctic. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. I think that's a pretty important point because I think some people have felt that, you know, the oil shale boom that you have in the lower 48 will now happen in Alaska, and that's still not proven technology, and that's why it's not in your forecast.
Through the chair, that is correct. It's while the shale does continue to hold promise.
Thank you.
Until a well can be tested and the flow patterns established and the extent and frackability of that formation can be confirmed through exploration and delineation drilling. It's so speculative that it would be, you know, following a scenario model of risking, it would be so de minimis that it wouldn't even be able to be seen on the forecast.
And just to follow up quickly on that point, to put it in context, the incredible potential that resource holds in Alaska when comparing it to the plays in North Dakota and Texas, you can drive to every square mile inch of both of those states practically, back a truck up, start drilling. While we've heard that the shale play on the North Slope could be 2-3 times the size of the Bakken, there is zero infrastructure up there. The two wells that have been drilled are directly off the haul road. So if we want to expand westward to get to this type of checkerboard that we see in North Dakota, it's going to be a tremendous economic and environmental process that we're going to have to go through in order to get out there and get to the resource. So while shale oil was not economic, again, known for decades in North Dakota, it did not become economic until prices hit $70 or $80 a barrel. So again, that's another concern that while we know of the resource, how are we going to get to it? Is it going to flow? And what's the projected oil price going to need to be for us to even realize that resource?
Okay, if I may follow up.
Senator Meyer.
Okay, and then going back to your previous slide, and also just follow up on the oil shale, I think they did actually, Great Bear did a press release saying that they have stopped their exploration or their drilling activity, at least for the time being. So in order to figure out your new oil and oil under evaluation, I think you said you meet with the producers, and if I know correctly, there's five producers or four: Pioneer, Eni, Conoco, BP, and then Exxon hopefully soon at Point Thompson.
And Savant.
And
Savant.
Savant? Okay. Okay, so you go to those five or six producers and you ask them, you know, what's in your plans for the next 5 years, and that's how you get your forecast for the new oil. You go to the existing fields?
Through the chair, that's correct. The consultant sits down and interviews all the respective clients, customers, producers, and gathers their gross production data. And again, I think it's important. We don't ask them to put a risking component on. We've actually over time just accepted the forecast they've given us on a gross basis. And what we then do in this new assessment is we look at what's the probability of that event occurring. In general, what has the history been of those events occurring, and associate then some risk in the out years for the preparation of a forecast for the policymakers to decide, and looking at longer-term business calls. And to Bruce's point earlier when he said the wrong people are at the table, a group of engineers sitting around thinking about, ooh, golly, what can I do and what kind of production forecast can I have, are always going to be a bit on the optimistic side. That's just kind of our nature. We think all things are possible, and we try and do our best to convince our senior management as engineers that our project should go forward, and that is kind of the project. The scope of how that interview takes place is the companies say, these are the things that we think we're going to be able to do, and we think these are the production profiles and timing associated with those. That being said, that is just a point in time and a point on production. But now really the key is that being said, how accurate have they been in terms of actuality?
And also through the chair, Senator Meyer, we do have discussions with the other explorers to get a handle on where they are in their process. So we're not making these judgment calls on whether to include them or not solely. We're discussing with them to find out where they are in their process, and then that goes into the forecast.
Good. Thank you.
So looking at one of the risks in just terms of time, a not too distant study by Booz Allen Hamilton, 35% of projects are over budget and exceed cycle time by more than 10%. That's an industry statement. That's not Alaska specific. That's an industry statement. But the reason why I include that as a point is that's an interesting reference to validate the fact that things over time cost more and are usually delayed. If you look at the exhibit in front of you, what you've got is, we went back, the revenue team and the DOG team went back and scoured some of the published articles, Petroleum News, ADN, Oil and Gas Journal, et cetera, associated with Alaskan projects. And 1 year, if you look at the number of, look at first row, is 1 year, so 1 year out, there were 12 predictions of imminent production. 12 were correct. So a company said, we're going to be online next year. 12 out of 12 were right on the mark. As you work your way through down in time, the further out you get, the less successful they were in predicting the actual time that the field or project would be online. The outlier is in year 7, there were 7 predictions. One was correct, and that was the North Star. At that time, North Star was predicted to be put online at a certain time, and it actually was based on that one interview that was recorded. Part of what I'm trying to do is just give you a bit of feel for the sensitivity that we looked at in terms of what is the likelihood of the events taking place on the date that they said they were going to take place. And clearly, as you are closer, you have a higher degree of confidence. As you get out, your confidence and your success diminish. So that's timing of a project. Now let's also look at the productivity of a project. We're not necessarily trying to pick on any one group or party. This is, again, these are just key selected items. I think it's important to note that some went up and some went down, and I'll show you that. Badami is one of the one that not only was late, but also has over a 50% error in initial production forecast. They predicted 30,000 barrels a day, and it came in at roughly 18,000. The Aurora project, somewhere between 15 and 20 was what was published. It actually came in at 10,000, again, roughly a 50% error. The Polaris water flood was expected to peak somewhere between 12 and 15,000 barrels a day, actually came in at less than 5,000. So again, roughly a 40% error. Prudhoe Bay satellites is kind of the outlier in this exhibit, but just to show that it can go the other direction, they predicted 40,000 barrels a day, and it peaked at 50. So while hopefully I've sensitized you a little bit in terms of those are the two components that we looked at, were really impact of time and impact of production. And we then turned around and let's reground ourselves. This
Senator Dunleavy,
quick question. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it would appear that the oil associated with Prudhoe Bay has exceeded predictions over the years.
Through the chair, that would be a correct assumption.
And those further out have underperformed. The majority of those projects have underperformed as predicted.
Through the chair, in the exhibit that you're looking at, that was just a Prudhoe Bay satellites was a positive success story. I think another success story would have been very clearly the gas cap water injection. There's many projects that did play positively, but there's just as many that played negatively. So again, we're trying to understand the impact of those two conditions.
One last follow-up. Because of Prudhoe producing over projections, did that ever play into the overall projections of oil production?
Through the chair, if I understand the question correctly, what we did is in the statistical review that I've already showed you, that increase and stabilization of production was included in that statistical assumption. So you look back over time and you use that as your primary database and then you project forward off of that. So the impact of positive impact of elevated production through the legacy fields is naturally ground into the assessment going forward from a decline curve analysis perspective.
So the surprise of Prudhoe became the norm for projecting or at least entered into that calculus?
To some degree, yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
And just to follow up through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, if you look back through previous revenue source books at the 10-year production forecast, by year 10, it was roughly a 50-50 mix of old oil and new oil. So as Director Barron mentioned, Prudhoe would have been included in that old oil, but the over-optimism was generally coming from the new oil that we were projecting half of total oil to be. In this revenue source book, if you look at in chapter 4, 10 years out, it's approximately 75-25. So more of the total oil is being coming from the currently producing section. Again, we recognize the upside in the underdevelopment, under evaluation. We're just not assuming it's going to come online by year 10.
More fully in an answer to that question, Senator, if again, the production graph on the screen, again, how we built that whole process of the standard deviation forecast, the reason why I asked the DOR team to give me two different confidence intervals was exactly to your point. The concern of being overly optimistic on all of ANS production over time, including the robust success of some of the projects at Prudhoe, tend to elevate and flatten the curve a little bit. By asking them to go back from 92 to 2006, what we did is naturally take that robustness out to a certain degree. And again, that's why if you look at the curve, in this example, the 2002 through 2006, there is a different decline component than if you were to look at 2007 to 2012. In fact, you could make a reasonable argument that there's actually three declines on that exact exhibit. You've got the one decline right there. You've got another decline going through here, right? And then you've got a third decline here, and then you've got a fourth decline in all of that, assuming all of it. So it's where you pick your data set will have a major impact on what your overall decline rate is. So to try and bound those two, that's why I asked the revenue team to do that statistical review. So the dashed lines that you've got, the big, bold dashed line green and the dashed line purple, establish kind of where the ditches are. And what we then did is, through a scenario model, wanted to take a look at where would we fall within those ditches, and would we? And if we fell outside of those ditches, then the DOG team needed to go back and rethink. All right, so this is, and lo and behold, the forecast as it would have normally been done historically, so this is very important. The red line you see on the exhibit now is the forecast with everything that we received from the producers unrisked. No risking, no risk scenario component at all. And it clearly breaches the upper confidence interval. And interestingly enough, would look very similar to all the historic production profiles presented by DOR to this body. We then took a look at if you took out all of the underdevelopment and under evaluation and said we are only going to look at currently producing, the black line is the result. So it falls well within the confidence intervals in the first couple of years and still stays within the lower confidence intervals even in the out years. It's not too dissimilar to what I would expect. The green line is the result of layering in the scenario model for under development and then under evaluation. And this falls nicely within the confidence intervals. It is a bit on the higher side of those windows, but still falls cleanly within the confidence intervals established with historic production in the North Slope. And again, this is just a longer-term view of from 78 through year-to-date and then out to 2012. The reason why it's important that we're showing you the high, the low, and the middle is the goal that was presented to the Division of Oil and Gas was, can you assist in coming up with a forecast that is reasonable and prudent for policymakers, the administration, to make long-term forecasts, long-term business decisions in preparing for the state. I would offer that what we've given you today is there's a high side that you can make business decisions on, which would be similar to the forecast that you've seen in the past. There's a low side that you can look at that says, gosh, if no new work is done, if no new fields are brought on, this is kind of what it's going to look like. And then there's the forecast that says, we think there's things that are going to happen. We know people are still continuing to spend money and projects are on the books. People are spending money on those projects. There's still exploration development going on, but they're out in time and they need to be risked in some manner. So this is a longer term view. So where is some of the differences? Pretty clear. It is all associated with the new oil. The blue bars are the 2011 forecast of new oil as a percent of the total production profile forecast in 2011. The red bars are the new oil percentage associated with the forecast that's being presented to this body. Clearly what we've done is we've taken off the high side. We've recognized there's timing risk and we've recognized there's production risk. And what we've done is we've tapered that down and modified the profile accordingly. So any good forecaster is kind of honor bound to do a look back in history to say, you now have a scenario model. How does that model compare if you were going to roll it back to old forecasts and see what it looks like? So we're back to my lovely diagram that some people love and some people hate. The red curve is the average that we showed you previously. The blue curve is the new error bars associated with if you'd used this technique and gone backwards and reforecast everything. The question is this forecast correct? I would offer that this forecast has taken out over 50% of the error from what historically would have been included in a forecast. The answer lies somewhere between the high side completely unrisked and the low side only currently producing. So the answer is somewhere in between. We believe that this is a forecast that is reasonable and prudent and gives policymakers a good go-by, a good benchmark for the planning of the state's business.
So in wrap-up, this is certainly not meant to be a doom and gloom scenario. The purpose of what we undertook was to reset a more conservative baseline for decision makers, both executive branch and legislative branch, while recognizing the tremendous upside that our state resources can possibly provide. Again, we're not saying these things are not achievable. We're just saying for short-term budgeting and long-term planning, we wanted to set a more conservative starting point. And to that end, we actually included the unrisked portion to show you what the previous methodology would have actually looked like. So we're not hiding anything. We're not presenting doom and gloom. We're putting everything in the revenue source book to help you folks make more informed decisions. There was... Yes, sir.
Changeman, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you. Mr. Changeman, is it conservative or is it realistic?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, I think it's both. And again, it's we're showing you low side, high side, and where we actually ended up. So it's both, and it's there to help you folks make more informed decisions, certainly. And again, when we were undertaking this process, there was quite a bit of concern, and rightly so, from the governor, from the commissioner, from Mr. Barron's commissioner, and in particular, our biggest concern was how was the rating agencies, was Wall Street, how are they going to look at the process that we were undertaking? Obviously, as Commissioner Butcher mentioned, both Moody's and S&P, we kept our AAA rating, and we were actually bumped up to AAA by Fitch this year, which has not happened before. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to read a short quote from S&P that was included in their analysis recently. And again, I'm not saying we held AAA rating because of the process we went through, but this is one of many variables that they look at. So according to S&P, the state's Department of Revenue has a good track record forecasting year-ahead prices and production levels. A big issue for the state is measuring the long-term rate of oil production decline. Since peaking in 1988, the average annual rate of decline in production has been around 5.5%. However, the state's long-term forecast has consistently projected a long-term rate of annual decline in oil production of just under 2.5% or lower. As a result, the state's long-term forecast has tended to overestimate actual production levels. While its fall 2012 forecast, or with its fall 2012 forecast, the Department of Revenue has revised the methodology used to develop its longer-term production forecast. The new approach applies risk factors to discount the projected oil production from old oil fields that are still under development or in the evaluation stage. Previously, production estimates in the forecast from such fields were not adjusted downward to account for their higher level of uncertainty. So when we, when the commissioner and Deputy Commissioner Odell were back in New York at the end of last year and they were getting this feedback, we knew that we were on the right track. Again, this isn't the end-all be-all. It will be a continued process where we will review what we've undertaken in the last year and revise it going forward to get hopefully more and more accurate. But we certainly think, based on the process we've put in place, and really, we take a lot of comfort in the fact that we can look backwards, and had this process been in place, the error rate would have been cut in half going forward. So we think that gives us a lot of comfort that we're certainly on the right path, and we'll continue to refine this as we go down the road. So with that, that's the end of our presentation and question.
Senator Dunleavy.
Just trying to make sure that I have my terms down. We use slope and we use Prudo and we use sometimes things of terms interchangeably. Is Kuparuk considered part of Prudo for the purposes of your slope curve on the big oil fields on the slope?
Through the chair, it's not part of Prudo. It's part of what I was calling ANS, Alaska North Slope. So okay. Kuparuk is rolled into that total number that was in the ANS curves.
Has Kuparuk exceeded its projected
production as Prudhoe has, or has it come within the projections, or has it underperformed?
Through the chair, it has overperformed from initial development concepts.
And
through a great deal of work by the operator.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Olson, did you have a question?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Tengman and Mr. Behrens. Commissioner Butcher, did you have an additional part
yes.
to this presentation? Okay. We'll just take a little of these here for a few moments while you get your people together. We're back on the record. Commissioner Butcher, proceed with the final portion of your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. With me is our Deputy Commissioner for Treasury and our State Treasurer, Angela Rodell. And Angela hates it when I do this, but to educate the committee, Angela's background was for 15 years she worked on Wall Street as a financial advisor for many of many states, but for the benefit of us, she worked for periodically Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Municipality of Anchorage, I think the airport, ADA, and so she had a great understanding of Alaska and its issues when we were fortunate enough to hire her as deputy commissioner. And she came in with a tremendous amount of expertise. In fact, last week we had a bond sale of 160 some odd million, the last piece of the 2010 GO, and we ended up with an all-in rate of 1.64%. So she's just done a tremendous job, and I bring this up because previously I've walked the committee through this particular slide deck, and last year it was because she was new, but she's not new anymore. So I'm going to ask the Deputy Commissioner Rodell to walk this through for you.
Deputy Commissioner, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You should have before you a presentation, which is an update on the state savings account. So the first page that we're going to go through is actually on the general fund and other non-segregated investments. This is the largest of the state accounts. As of December 31st, 2012, it had a balance of approximately $11.67 billion. The big portion of that, for your information, is approximately $5.48 billion is located in the statutory budget reserve. And really, that has almost doubled. The statutory budget reserve has practically doubled since last year, and that's due to a $1.75 billion deposit that was made in fiscal year 12, a $250 million deposit made in fiscal year 2013, and then an additional $805 million from fiscal year 12 surpluses. The other portion of it is really with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and Alaska Housing Capital Corporation. Both have significant, almost $1 billion deposited, and that is in the other non-segregated portion. This fund has a moderate risk profile. It has short to intermediate investment horizon, and this is due to the fact that it is our general fund. It is what we pay our bills out of every single day. We are looking at a return rate for fiscal year 2012 of 1.52%, and our projected 10-year rate over the next 10 years is expected to be 2.87. This year, fiscal year to date, we've got a return of 0.37%, and as I know most of you know, short-term cash treasury bills are just not yielding any sort of return of note. On page 4, we have the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, both the main fund and the subfund. The main fund had a balance on December 31st of approximately $5.7 billion, and the subfund had a balance of $5.5 billion. Just to note, this does include the money that was paid by BP under the settlement. So the Constitutional Budget Reserve received a deposit in December of $160 million from that settlement. The balance of the settlement went to the Public School Trust Fund and the Permanent Fund Corporation. We have a fiscal year to date return of for 2012 of 3.22% on the CBR main fund. And that's primarily because we keep that in more intermediate, shorter term, lower moderate risk investments. The sub fund was the portion that was carved off to take a higher risk profile, and that has approximately 60% in equities. And so that's showing the higher return, but you can see the volatility as well from the year to date of 11.2% versus a 5-year return of 2.6%. On page 5 are the returns for the Power Cost Equalization Fund. It had a balance on December 31st of $787 million. This was invested primarily in equities and fixed income. It has a higher risk profile. The reason for the higher risk profile, quite honestly, is because we have a 7% targeted payout on this fund. And so in order to try and hit that payout target, we take a higher risk investment asset allocation. The fiscal year to date is 7.38%, so it looks like we are going to, hopefully, if the fiscal year continues on the track the markets are currently on, that we will hit that 7%. And as you can see, we've projected 10-year returns, so we've designed the asset allocation around trying to achieve that 7%. Moving on to the Public School Trust Fund, this fund received a portion of the BP settlement. It has a current balance on December 31st, I should say, of $487 million. And then we sweep the dividend payments, the interest earnings, into the income fund. And that has a very low-risk, short investment horizon because that is the money that then gets appropriated out to the schools for the foundation formula, excuse me. We have a fiscal year to date of 4.93%, a projected return of 5.59. So this has a little bit of equity in it, approximately 27% in the principal fund, and so we are able to generate a little bit more income off of this fund. Okay. That concludes the state funds, and then we also have responsibility for overseeing the PERS and TERS investments. These both have moderate risks. We have a target actuarially assumed rate of return of 8% on both TERS and PERS, and the asset allocations have been designed around that, with an eye towards the benefit requirements, so the payout. So we need to maintain a certain amount of cash in low short-term investments in order to be able to maintain our ability to make those benefit payouts. The balance of the PERS as of December 31st was $12,016,000,000, and the fiscal year 2012 return to date was a half of 1%. This year, we're off to a much better start. The markets have turned around to some degree, and we're looking at a fiscal year to date of 5.63%. TERS has a balance of $5 billion. They had a fiscal year of return for 2012 of 0.59%, and we are looking at a fiscal year to date return of about 5.68%. this is the information for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. They had a balance of $43,654,000,000 as of December 31st. So as you can see, they were able to really turn things around. The markets cooperated with them from 2011 to 2012. Their fiscal year 2012 return was basically they broke even at 0.02%. They're currently seeing, though, a nice, healthy 7.34% for the fiscal year to date. And quite honestly, they're allowed to take a little bit higher risk asset allocation than the Retirement Management Board, because the Retirement Management Board obviously has to pay out benefits, whereas the Permanent Fund Corporation doesn't have sort of the same sort of requirement that the Armed Board does. So if there are no questions about the status of the savings accounts through December 31st, we can move on to page 10, which is just the investment revenue forecast. And one of the things that we've done that is slightly different than last year is that we have gotten rather than using our 10-year return assumption on cash of 2.87, we've looked at what we're actually earning on cash, which is closer to somewhere between 0.3 and 0.6, and we're actually using 0.6 for the forecast. So you'll see that some of the investment income is lower than it's been in the past, and that's just to take into account current market conditions and the current interest environment that we're in for the short-term market. And if there are no other questions, I think that concludes my presentation.
Questions?
One quick.
Senator Bishop?
Yes, ma'am. Just a question. You can do a follow-up with my office if you don't have it off the top of your head. What's the historical average on the permanent fund return, percentage-wise?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we will get back to you on what that is exactly. It's been pretty healthy, and the projection of 5% real is not unrealistic based on its what it's done historically, but we'll get you the exact number. As I mentioned earlier, last year was flat, the year before was 20%, and so far this year it's 7%, so it's been all over the place lately.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Angela, did you have a comment?
No, that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell me if under an allocation on a capital budget appropriation, $100 million is designated for expenditure, does that move into a different risk pool as far as moving from long-term investment over into short-term investment and providing a lower rate of return?
Through the chair, Senator, it does move to a short term. Once that money gets committed out of the reserves, and we know it's going to be spent, so if it's not in, you know, I think, but because we're not using the reserves, if it's in general fund, it's already in short term. So then it
wouldn't change.
It wouldn't change. No, it's only if it would move out of the reserves, out of the constitutional budget reserve, actually, because the general fund has the statutory budget reserve within its corpus.
Mr. Chairman, if I might follow.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you. Is there, are we experiencing any disadvantage when we have had for the last 2 years significantly larger capital budgets in the billions that we've used general fund revenue and that we know that some of those allocations will not be used for a number of years, that we don't leave them in longer term investments? I'll give you an example of my own project on the Glen Highway. It's bonding, so it's a little bit different, but there might be $30 million. We could go for an intertie in Southeast that might have $100 million. And we're using general funds that we know we won't access a majority of those in construction for a number of years. Significant, maybe at least two, if not five, depending on permitting. But those funds are being left in the general fund as a short-term asset versus investment that we could be receiving if we establish another kind of investment strategy for those longer-term projects. So is there an advantage for us to look at something like that?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Fairclough, our chief investment officer, Gary Bader, we can probably come to your office and give you a little bit more detail on that. One of the real challenges of not just the general fund, but obviously the retirement funds as well, is the balancing act between how much you have to keep liquid and how much you're able to invest a little bit longer term. And so he could give you a little bit more detail on how we do that and how we make sure we're not with that we can invest it for a greater return without leaving ourselves short liquidity-wise.
And if I could just add to that, if you look on the general fund investments, we do have about 47% in intermediate term bond, which is about a 1 to 3 year horizon. And that's helping to push the yields closer to the 1% mark rather than at the, you know, 0.1, 0.10. But when you average the stuff in, and along with the liquidity needs, we're just not getting the returns. And you really have to go much, much farther out to get any sort of yield right now, and I don't know that we're prepared to do that. But as the commissioner said, we'd be more than happy to go into more detail with the CIO.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just was wondering whether this committee wanted to look at that policy decision because we are making those incremental payments on the PERS and TERS system directly out of the general fund, and we propose to do so into the future. So specific to the PERS and TERS and the ARM board, if those were moved into possibly more risky financial proposals, that we may see a greater rate of return to close that shortfall that I believe may increase on us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner?
That's all we have, unless there are further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Senator Dunleavy?
Just a quick one. Looking out, I don't know if you've done this, but looking out, let's say, 5 years, is there anything you see that concerns you that we should be aware of from your perspective?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, this is something that we spend considerable amount of time on, not just internally, but I sit on the ARM board as well as Deputy Commissioner Rodell has a role on that, and I'm on the permanent fund board as well. And what's over the next 5 years, the greatest uncertainty, and almost anybody you talk to would agree with this, is where the global economy is going. And periodically, we focused on what's happening with Europe and the uncertainty of the euro, or the slowdown in China and India, or what's going on in our country. And you begin to look with some uncertainty at some areas, but it's important to understand that if you were to, say, make a decision to not invest in Europe, you have to invest someplace, and you want to invest in a place better than where you took your money out of. And right now, just the global uncertainty is causing the most concern with folks. That and the fact that traditionally when the market feels uncertainty, they go to treasuries, which makes you a lot less money, but it's secure, and you know you're not going to lose money. But with treasuries at almost zero, and occasionally even to a negative, where to go to treasuries, you would lose money. It's kind of left everybody in a situation of kind of an unease as to what's going to happen next. So that's what most of the focus has been.
If there aren't any further questions. Oh, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last year, we were considering legislation to make deposits to the PERS and TERS fund. And the primary reason was that we were going to see drastic increases in the deposits from the general fund. This year, I believe that they're not as large for FY14 as they will be in 15, 16, and 17. We're going to see 3, 4, 5 time fold increases. And I'm wondering, does administration have any solutions, or are we just going to see larger chunks of deposits required every fiscal year between now and the near future?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that is something that the board and the Department of Revenue has spent a lot of time digging into, which is to lay out all the options that might be available to the board and ultimately to the governor and the legislature, from an escalating amount going in from the general fund, which is currently kind of the plan that's been before you for the last few years, as well as other possibilities such as potentially a lump sum, potentially the selling of pension obligation bonds, which is something that was discussed years ago when the interest rates were higher, to make sure that we take a look at everything on the table and we make the most prudent decisions moving forward on that. So
a follow-up, do we have a time?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have a timetable as when those proposals may be coming forward before the legislature?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we'll be having an ARM board meeting next month, and usually that's the meeting that we talk about internally if any bills are having been presented, or are there things that we want to bring to the legislature's attention. So that would be the timeline I would expect.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I know everyone has to go quickly to the to other meetings. We'll just adjourn this meeting. Thank you all for being here.